Alrighty. Good afternoon. My name is Julie Fedorchak. I'm the chairman of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. We are gathered for a work session on case number 10-73, the Tatanka Wind Power LLC decommissioning plan and costs. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Crosius, do you have any?
No, I do not. Thank you.
All right. Then I will turn it over to the portfolio holder on this, which is Commissioner Chrisman.
So, barring being corrected, because it was kind of focused on the previous one, there's really, I think, two significant issues here. One is to redo the decommissioning plan, and instead of dismantling the facilities, as all of our other decommissioning plans have done, to use this felling method, which would lower the cost estimate significantly and thus lower the financial assurances required significantly. Then the second question is this accelerated escrow account, mm-hmm. which by my understanding is rather than placing the amount of the financial assurances for the full estimated cost of decommissioning with us, you'd start making payments and then over time hopefully catch up to it. So I think those are the two issues to discuss here. And so before we start, if I could just get that clarified that I'm not missing anything.
Yep, you're right.
Okay. So I don't know if either of you have particular questions on it. I will say this, as far as taking the second one first, I think we really gave good and thorough contemplation to our financial assurance requirements when we did the administrative rules, and my preference is to stick with it. And you know, if we start doing this, others will, I'm sure, want to do it too. It doesn't require so much up front. But if someone gets into one of these, and we have a lot of wind farms in the state, and they're all building up to that point of decommissioning to first have enough money there, if something happens to one of the companies halfway through and the company sinks or for some reason divests itself of this, then we're left sitting with only partially enough money to decommission it. And so I think our current rules are thorough and adequate, and we should stick with them. And if there's not any other...
Well, I wanted to make sure. Did you have any?
No.
I wanted to ask, since this escrow, this approach, this accelerated cash escrow, it's not something we've done before, and I don't know much about it. I mean, my initial thought was, no, like, I don't like the idea of building up over time, but are there some benefits that I'm not understanding or that don't come to mind at first blush to what the company is proposing here that we ought to consider? The cash part being a piece of it that I think might be valuable.
Yeah, they definitely are proposing to actually put cash in the Bank of North Dakota every year. I think one of the company's concern is that they have an investor, a tax equity investor involved. And part of that partnership, they would have to rewrite their governing rules that dictates how that cash flow is dispersed. It's not impossible, but they would need approval from the other investor involved in this project. So I think that was one of the major concerns that the company had.
And that's for this approach?
Right.
Okay, well then why wouldn't they go with the other approach? I guess what are the advantages to this approach?
The advantage to this approach is that it would, from the company's perspective, it would be easier for them to administer it, and possibly, from what I gather, I would have to look into it a little bit more, but it sounds as if they wouldn't have to change their governing guidelines.
I'm not sure you two are on the same page as of which is this approach
right.
and which is the other approach.
I'm not, I think we're...
So then the other approach being the bond?
Why don't you do the current methodology mm-hmm. as opposed to the proposed methodology?
Sure, the current would be the bonding.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so for the bonding one, the advantage of that is that if they go bankrupt, let's say, then we could draw on that right
yeah.
away.
I get that, but why does the company not want to do that? Is that where they have to change their governing rules?
Yeah, governing rules as well as it would be more costly
okay.
for a bond.
All right, and so this one, now going to the advantages for the company and if there's any advantages for us, or us being the public of this approach, that they're proposed approach, the accelerated cash escrow approach.
I can't see one.
An advantage?
I would be stretched to find an advantage.
Okay.
For us.
For us, yeah.
I think one advantage is instead of drawing out a bond, the cash would actually be there if it got to the point where the cash was actually there. We wouldn't have to do anything. The account's there and we would have access to it. So, but the risk is in the meantime, while these payments are being made, if something happens, there's a gap mm-hmm. coverage there that that wouldn't exist. So, but end of the day, having cash in hand, I think, is advantageous, but you know, unless it's all deposited right away, there's risk until we get to that amount.
In the short and mid-term?
Correct.
Short-term being higher risk, mid-term being low risk, long-term being really essentially, it becomes an advantage at that point?
Possibly. I mean, I know it's definitely better than a letter of credit because to demand on those, we have to actually go to wherever the letter is issued from and demand it with bonds. I'm not so sure if we have to physically go there and do that. So there, I mean, there are some steps to letters of credits and bonds that, you know, cash in hand would probably eliminate. But is it a huge difference or a huge advantageous? No, but it is one.
What would the schedule, escrow schedule be?
It's starts in 2021. They propose it starts at around $443,000, and then it goes up incrementally through the end of the project useful life, which is 2038. So about it's between $440,000 to $620,000 that would be deposited.
17.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
It's year 17.
Well, it'll go out till 2038. So from 2021 to 2038.
It's year 30 of the wind farm because they're already 12, 13 years old.
Yeah.
I guess I was a little surprised to see the 17 years, like to take this that full amount of time. I thought maybe they'd propose doing it quicker, which would have made me feel more comfortable because then you'd have the full balance sooner. You know, you could cut in half the number of years that the risk would be in, the pool would be more substantial earlier on. So mm-hmm. that was when I looked at the schedule, I thought, geez, I mean, it does stretch it out a long ways.
Right. They are not proposing, because it is like 12, 13 years, they're not proposing to deposit a larger chunk up front.
Yeah.
For instance, because this is, you know, fairly depreciated already.
Mm-hmm. Would that change your thoughts on it, Randy, if we had some sort of a modified approach where we got a greater amount up front?
It would have to be so fast that I don't think that it would make much difference to the company. My really big concern on these is, especially with some of the latest news that I read this morning about you know, proposals in DC to really enhance the incentives for building renewables. And, you know, what we do here will spread to other cases too. And with so much of the, let's say it's a 30-year lifespan project, so much of the revenue coming in the first year through the first 10 years through the subsidies, at some point does it get to be where these things are so lucrative to build and have for the first 10 years that they just start abandoning them after year 10 because you got to build a new one to get PTCs. And I don't want a bunch of 10-year-old projects to come back to us. And here we're at 30% of the cost of reclamation.
Yeah, I mean, it is a major step away from what we've said, which is have this full amount from the first day of operation, right? I mean, that's what our, isn't that what our rules call for? Having the full, like we have a construction piece, and then we require that the full amount of the decommissioning costs be provided for through financial assurances from the first day of operation.
Before they begin operations.
Yeah. So, I mean, you could, that begs the question, does this even meet those, the requirements that we've already laid out in our rules?
I believe, Brian, do you have that on hand? I believe it gives the commission some discretion.
Right, but discretion on the methodology, but the amount? I mean, does this stretch that discretion further than what we intended? Is my, I guess, what I'm wondering.
Well, it says that they have to provide it prior to operation an amount that is acceptable to the commission. So I guess that can be whatever we find acceptable and sufficient to ensure complete decommissioning. So I'm not so sure a lesser amount could be defined as being sufficient to complete decommissioning.
I don't know that it even meets the requirements of our rules. Yes, we have the authority to entertain different approaches and stuff, and we have, and we'll continue to, but providing, you know, this small amount, $500,000, you know, for decommissioning moving forward for this year, and then only a million after that, and a million and a half is... What's the term adequate for decommissioning? Amount?
Sufficient to ensure complete decommissioning.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, on those grounds alone, I don't know if this qualifies. Brian, are you seeing something differently?
6909, 908, subsection 3, financial assurance may be in the form of a performance bond, either as or a combination of cash.
Sorry. 6909, 0908, number 3, financial assurance may be in the form of a performance bond, either as a combination of cash, escrow held by a federally insured financial institution, a surety bond, irrevocable letter of credit, guarantee, parent guarantee, or another form of financial assurance that is acceptable to the commission to cover the anticipated cost of decommissioning. So I would assume that this would fall under another form of financial insurance. So
yeah, but to ensure the estimated cost of decommissioning is the piece there.
And I think more important, Brian, is the one before that, number 2, that prior to commencement of operation of a facility, the owner shall provide financial assurance that is acceptable to the commission and sufficient to ensure complete decommissioning.
Yeah, I was going to mention that one next. I had read that while I was getting to that other one.
What's the definition of decommissioning in that?
We have a definition for decommissioning plan. Decommissioning plan means a plan filed with the commission that includes the anticipated life of the facility, a decommissioning cost estimate excluding salvage offsets that reduce decommissioning cost, description of the method used for determining the decommissioning cost estimate, the anticipated manner in which the project will be decommissioned, description of any expected effects on present and future natural resource development, and a detailed plan of financial assurance sufficient to ensure decommissioning.
So does decommissioning, by the definitions we've laid out, is it defined to be at the end of its useful life?
Yeah, that's in here somewhere. Let me see if I can find it. So it says abandonment and useful life. After construction of a facility is complete, the owner shall annually file a certificate. If no energy is generated by one or more wind turbines for a time period specified in the certificate of operation, a written explanation of why not, it's presumed to be at its end of its useful life when its annual capacity factor is less than 10%. It's presumed abandoned after commencement of construction. In completion of a period of 24 consecutive months have passed with no significant construction.
So this contemplates abandonment too, which is kind of more what we'd be getting at here in terms of requiring something sooner than what their estimated end of useful life is.
So that one is after commencement of construction and prior to completion. So that's in the construction phase as for abandonment. Once it starts, it's either gonna, once it reduces to 10% or, well, so if they stop operating it, it's not gonna produce 10% of its nameplate, so it would then be presumed to be at the end of its life, I think technically. But then in the decommissioning period, they have 12 months after abandonment of useful life to decommission it. And then I guess as far as a definition of decommissioning, there's 6909-0905, which is the decommissioning requirements, which details what it is.
Well, I guess maybe to cut to the chase and where I am on this one, I would support the company's plans to use the felling method and probably oppose the accelerated cash escrow.
Adam, do you have an estimate on the annual cost for bonding in the amount of almost $8.9 million?
I could get that for you. Not off the top of my head.
Do you think there's a financial benefit to the escrow, accelerated escrow method versus just purchasing the bond?
Yeah, it's cheaper for the company because they just have to push money around, and so it doesn't have associated annual fees with bonding.
I'd be curious to know what the annual cost of the...
Yeah, we can get that. Yeah.
Maybe on just for future reference on a per million basis.
Mm-hmm.
That way I have a number I can apply to any company, and I realize it depends, but just a general estimate of, it's approximately this. Yes, there are variables, but that'll move the number around a little bit on a per-million-dollar basis, but that'd be beneficial.
Okay, we'll do that.
Did you want that before we reach a conclusion on this case? Or is it something for long-term strategy?
I think it's more on long-term strategy. Mm-hmm. Bonding is a pricey proposition, obviously, but there is a small, certain degree of irony if the concern is that the facility is not going to be liquid. over the course of time, and that's a concern. This doesn't push them into that direction or assist them in remaining the level of liquidity needed from a cash flow standpoint to stay in the marketplace, so to speak. And then do we drive in early retirement, which isn't, everyone's on the same playing field when they're bonded, essentially. But there's an advantage to others that are able to self-bond.
So I'm not hearing a strong desire in this case to allow for the change to the accelerated, or is there?
No.
Okay. Then on the felling part of it, I am not going to support allowing that, but I want to clarify what I mean by that, because when the first and maybe subsequent wind farms do decide to shut down and begin their decommissioning, I think I would be very open to trying it. But I've not seen enough from quick TikTok or YouTube videos to convince me that that is not damaging to the ground when those are hitting, or leaving a mess of materials. There just isn't enough there. And again, if in this case the estimate was going from 15.75 million down to less than 9 million, so somewhere between half and two-thirds the cost. If we say now that we will allow the felling method, everyone will immediately switch to that. I mean, why wouldn't they? And if it turns out that it is problematic, then we have financial assurance for everyone to only reclaim in a problematic manner. Now, when the first one gets to this stage, I would like to see us continue as we have been requiring these and with the and only approving the decommissioning plans as we have in the past, where you come in with cranes and you dismantle them and remove them. When one happens, if they want to at that point come in with a different plan and say we want to try felling, I don't think at that point, unless I've learned something different, that I would be adverse to letting someone try it. And then if it is problematic, we won't ever allow anyone else to try it. But if it does turn out to be a problem when they do it, the rest, we don't have to allow it then. I think this really relates back to the way we do things with coal mine reclamation. We require a bond amount that assumes the worst case financial amount. And, you know, those are calculated out, you know, with seed costs, equipment costs, all kinds of things. But of course, equipment and labor costs are a big part of it. And we're used to those coal mines having those enormous pieces of equipment that no one else in the state has. And so when they're doing their reclamation, they're using that very efficient large equipment. But our bonding on the mine plans on using equipment that we could get a contractor to use. Clearly less efficient, but that would be our costs. And I think here too, maybe this ends up working out and they will have more financial assurances setting here. They won't use it all and they'll get money back. But at the end of the day, if we short ourselves on the financial assurances and it turns out that this is not a good way of doing it long term, we will be left with inadequate bonding on all of the wind farms. And so I am not in favor of approving these as the decommissioning plan at this point. I will be open to looking at it when one is ready to actually do decommissioning if they want to attempt to change their plan.
What is the recourse? Let's end the scenario that if felling was approved and all the other wind farm operators, owners said, well, we want to do the same thing. And then the first, at some point in time, one of them is decommissioned, and let's say it doesn't work. And it's a mess. It's just not good. How quickly can we react to the others who, I agree, they would come in droves saying we want to do the felling method. How quickly could we then reverse or modify those so felling wasn't an option? I'm just looking at it, not to say that that's the route to go, but I just want to compare. There's two ways of coming at this, and just so I have adequate information.
It would be challenging. You'd have to, the commission would have to request an update to the decommissioning plan. Somehow we'd have to state our preference for them not to use the felling approach, and then they would start to trickle in. You know, it's taken, I don't know how many decommissioning plans there are, maybe like 30, 40. So it would be pretty onerous. Maybe a year, you know, to be realistic. I mean, maybe 6 months to if we were really pushing it.
And any new wind farms that get constructed after we would start this would have a very good case that, but we came to your state and constructed under the understanding we could do it this way. Now you're changing your requirements on us midstream.
Mike, Brian.
The only thing that requires them to update it is the time limit and statute. So unless we call for them to come in, it would be just as they came back in for renewal on it, and then we'd have to reject those plans and tell them that we want it up because we need the cranes in there. But there probably is, I think, like Adam said, the ability to call them back, but that would not be a fun process.
How would a rule change impact it? I mean, could we make a rule change that would require them to or not retroactively?
To retroactively?
To say, like, this method is no longer approved, you know, all wind farms need to have decommissioning. Plans.
Oh, no, here it is. The commission may at any time require the owner to file an updated decommissioning plan. It's the last section in 6909.06.
So that would accommodate technology changes that we learn along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Randy, I mean, I think you make really good points, and I think it's always the risk of doing something that's new. It has been, according to their documentation, 12 projects where it's been used in 4 states. So I guess from my perspective, I'm not sure that I need to have proof here in North Dakota that it works here. To be able to say that it works, you know, like we hadn't used the light mitigating technology. strategy here in North Dakota either, and we adopted that because it was proven elsewhere and approved by the FAA. So, I mean, maybe our record is too weak on it, or we haven't gotten enough information about those projects, or, you know, because we really don't have a ton. The little video that we got is about it, but, you know, I guess I'm kind of basing my willingness on the fact that it has been done elsewhere, and I haven't heard anything terrible about those things, but we haven't really reached out and gotten a bunch of information either, so I wonder if beefing up our information with more information on these 12 projects in four states, or getting, you know, some feedback from those four states, or if the company were to, you know, we don't have the staff to do all this research, but if they were motivated to do that, if we might, you know, if that might be helpful to better analyze this technique and its impact. So it's going to be a long time before we have any, you know, any experience with it here in North Dakota. This industry is so new.
Also, as we've learned with our vast experience in mining, you know, soil compaction issues sometimes take years and years to show up. And I don't recall what those states were. You know, a lot of states don't even really have reclamation requirements. So, I mean, I don't doubt that the felling method works as far as getting the turbines down. I just don't know that it works and is in the best interest of the environment and the land. I don't know how much fiberglass dust winds up in the air. I don't know how many small particles end up all over in the soil. Fiberglass isn't something you really want spread all over the place, and I don't know what kind of soil compaction is caused by it. But like I say, because other states accept it, and maybe those are states that aren't as concerned about reclamation as North Dakota has been. Our mine reclamation is stricter than some of the other states too.
I think, if I remember right from the presentation and just design, most of it falls on the area where that big concrete pad is. I can't remember if the top of the turbine, when it tips over, goes over the edge of that, the concrete foundation or anchor that's under the ground. But I think a lot of where the tower hits is ground that gets dug up, and they take the concrete out anyway. So compaction is an issue, but I'm not sure how far away from the base that is happening. But yeah, as far as the blades do break, in all the videos I've seen, they all do snap, but it's tough to say what, if any, fiberglass is coming off of those. There could be. Those videos aren't exactly up close and personal because of safety reasons. So.
Has the DEQ weighed in? I'm assuming not, in terms of, and not in this particular case, but in a previous case in another industry, we said we're hands off on air quality. And that wasn't the exact wording, but no, that's the DEQ. So, you know, if we're going to be consistent in one area, we need to be consistent in other areas. I just wish I had more data and information. A lot of this is, the conversation seems to be based on the unknown and the fear of what might happen, versus knowing what will happen. And I think the honest answer is, we don't know.
Well, we don't have enough information on what the places where it has been used. Because, I mean, there is experience.
Well, I know one tower that might be coming down soon that we could maybe pull over.
But from, would it be accurate, again, based on other unrelated discussions, but just along the same lines, that whether it's dust or fiberglass particles, that we defer to the DEQ on those issues?
I don't even know if the fiberglass, I guess I never thought about it as an air quality thing. I always thought about ground contamination. is where my concern would have been, because there's no, you can't take a metal detector out to find where it's at. It's just there, and there's no way to detect it.
But I thought it was, your concern in part was particles in the air.
I did say that, and you're probably right that that is probably outside of our realm, but I had mentioned both ground and air, so.
Okay, but the ground, that is within our purview, authority.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of decommissioning. The topsoil has got to be, you know, replaced, and you know, as part of the reclamation of the tower site, you know, we get into the ground.
We don't have any evidence, any studies that would on sites that the felling method was applied that prove that compaction is or isn't?
I mean, I guess short of reaching out to a state where this has happened and what they're and finding out what they experienced with it, I think that would be probably the easiest way to get some of these answers.
Well, on a brief, lighter note, and I think I can only imagine if people knew that towers are going to be tipped over, that law enforcement would be a little bit busy keeping the roadways clean. Or, you know, people are going to be parked on the side of the road if this were a thing, and watching it would be a bit of a headache. I would, frankly, probably want to go watch out of curiosity, but that's beside the point.
You want to watch from the right direction and far enough away.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a couple options. Prove it, deny it, or ask them for more information. And that's pretty much where we're at. I mean, I'd be open to that. I'd be open to asking them for, if they can get us more information on the 12 projects in the four states, and, you know, any testimonials from the regulatory bodies in those states. I think that burden is the companies to give us that, and it might be helpful to have, just so we know what's going on in, you know, these sort of cutting edge approaches on this industry. It's always going to be evolving, so I kind of like to do that, but
it seems like there almost needs to be an advocacy side, because, you know, no matter what industry, I don't mean to single out wind in this case, but with any industry, and to use wind as the example, yes, there are some landowners, for example, that are, you know, huge beneficiaries, and you know, maybe they've had some felled in their area, and they've gotten other turbines by the company, and they're huge fans. So, yeah, they can come in with a testimonial, and from a farmer that says, "Yeah, everything is fine." But without an advocacy side of it, it seems like it, I mean, just logically, all those tons and tons and tons falling, there has to be some impact.
Well, that's why, and I said testimonials from state regulatory bodies, where they've used this.
If they have regulatory authority, if there's someone that has authority over it and is monitoring it,
right?
That I would be interested in.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting into an area that's way above my pay grade, and that is when the cranes come in, the tires, the pounds per square inch on that tire traveling across, they're very, obviously, I don't know what a crane weighs, 50 tons, 80 tons, 100 tons?
Depends on the crane, yeah.
Right, it depends on the crane, but that soil compaction from the tires, right. Even if it's on the roadway, that's going to be reclaimed, but I don't know how big the area is next to the tower that the cranes are positioned on. You know, the feet go down, tremendous compaction in a small area. I mean, it's really getting into the types of measurements and whatnot that I don't know. I understand the concept. I don't know how to measure. I would like to see I mean, if there's any information out there, I'd like to see that, that no, this is a benefit. Because my concern goes back to the landowner as well. And if it actually is better for the person owning the land, and there's science to back that up, then I would be inclined to say, yes, the felling method, it's good for the owner of that land, even though it seems messy when things fly every which way when they come down. But how, I mean, when they, are they tipping the length of the turbine? But you had said that the impact area is closer to the foundation, so am I missing something?
No, I'm saying I don't know how far that, I know those foundations go all the way from, you know, the grade of water, so I don't know how much the foundation that I'm interested in inside.
Oh.
But it looks like when they tip, they don't seem to go all the way from the base, it literally just falls over from the base out.
But that's like 500 feet.
Into
the blade.
Yeah.
Half that distance or a little more to the end of the hub.
From what I have seen is the turbine is where most of the, at the top of it's where most of the impact is. The blades, most of the ones I've seen have been on the upside. And then when it hits the ground, they fracture not that far away from the hub. And pretty much usually off the blade. They don't shatter into many pieces, but they usually see the break, or some of them hang, some of them break. But it looks like the top of the turbine generation is where the most impacts on the top of itself.
And the blades are lighter, too, where they're hitting it. It's not that kind of weight to it.
Yeah, that's correct.
So, again, I mean, you talked about benefits, the area that we didn't discuss, and even though I'm not convinced by what I've heard so far to allow either of these aspects, the real benefit to North Dakota would be that in this case they're offering that if they got this, they're a company that is grandfathered in at only removing the concrete to 3 feet below the surface. And they're offering to go 4 feet. And so that is a benefit that I'll point out, even though it doesn't make my case. At this point, I would be a denial on both, but I think I'm sensing a desire to maybe reopen the case and allow the company to present more evidence.
Well, it's not closed, is it?
Well, have another.
Informal.
Are you talking about going to another informal hearing or just having them submit more hard copy stuff?
I'd be open to either. Yeah. If they have it, you know, and maybe we give them a deadline so we can wrap this up.
Yeah, I would think starting with a data request. Do you have any supporting data? And if the answer is no, then I don't think we need an informal because there's a lack of information to base a decision on.
So there's this paragraph 4, or on page 4, the top of page 4 of their April of 2021 filing, April 14th. And that's where they say, give like as evidence they got the Cerro Gordo wind project in Clear Lake, Iowa. Then it says, there's 12 projects where the felling technique has been used in 4 states. The decommissioning of the Cerro Gordo wind project was accomplished during the summer of 2020. So whatever information they can provide, including, if it's available, experiences from the regulatory bodies in those states that might oversee it, that would be really helpful to have.
Do we just rely on this, that the company has heard this now, or do we need to do something formally that reaches out to them? And I think we'd be...
You gotta turn your mic on, Brian.
I'm hearing that we would be open if they would like another informal to having that or just having them submit information.
Sure, I'm pretty sure the company has heard, but we can send out it in the form of data request and that way they formally have it, and just with that data request, leave it open for the method in which they would prefer to give it to us, if it be just to submit the information or to present it at an informal, I think would be sufficient. Did you hear that, Casey?
Is it unreasonable, since they're not part of the case, for us to reach out to, and I don't know who, maybe it's DEQ, maybe it's our own reclamation people upstairs that have understanding of soil compaction issues and such, for thoughts on this?
I don't think there's ever any harm in us trying to educate ourselves more on the issues that we're trying to understand. So I don't think there's an issue to finding out some of that information.
Would that require then an informal, so that if the company wanted to dispute some information, they had the opportunity?
I think if we were going to use it for our decision, that we would have to have a record of where that information came from.
Well, maybe I won't even think of anything, but I guess I'd like to leave that option open, too.
Sure.
Seeing if there's any more information we can garner.
Okay. Anything more from you, Brian?
No.
Randy, you done?
I am.
Okay. Well, thanks for that good discussion. That concludes the work session on PU-10-73.